Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Douglas Melamed. I represent the petitioner Rambus. This is an unprecedented antitrust case. The Commission ruled that Rambus violated a duty affirmatively to aid its rivals when it failed to disclose to them certain of its patent interests. The Commission found such a duty solely because of Rambus's membership in the JEDEC standard-setting organization, even though no JEDEC rule required such disclosure. And the Commission found an antitrust.
It's more than membership, right? It's, I mean, isn't the key attendance at meetings? At least the language of 21I, manual 21I, makes meetings, attendance at meetings, trigger some duties.
Well, the language of 21I, which was adopted, as I suspect you know, Judge Williams, after the adoption of the SDRAM standard.
It was, but there's testimony that the Commission cites members saying that that incorporated the previous understanding.
There was one passage that said it was to clarify previous understandings. And that is significant because 21I referred to an obligation to bring to the attention of others at JEDEC patents and pending patents or pending applications. It made no reference to an obligation to disclose the intentions to file new applications in the future, and it is undisputed that Rambus had no pending claims or issued claims that read on the standards while it was a member.
Can I ask you, before we get too deeply into this and what the manual says, and so, is the duty to disclose whatever it encompasses, maybe nothing, maybe something, is that a factual question or a legal question?
Well, I think there are both factual and legal questions. There is a factual question of whether there was an expectation among members at JEDEC that intentions to file applications in the future would be disclosed. As to that, by the way, I don't even think the Commission made a finding, and if they did, I don't think there's evidence to support it. But beyond that, there are a series of important legal questions that would say even if there were an expectation, a subjective expectation among JEDEC members, that this kind of trade secret information would be exchanged, the question is whether not living up to those expectations violates an antitrust duty.
Okay, now, that's a legal question, you say.
Right.
Okay. Is the duty to disclose, though, is that if it derives, as the FTC sometimes says, from the confluence of the manual and how people understood it, and so is that governed by state law, or is that governed by federal law?
Well, I don't think there is in this case any argument that Rambus breached a contract or violated any other body of law that would impose upon it a disclosure obligation. I think the Commission's theory is that that some people expected a disclosure and that somehow imposed on Rambus an antitrust duty to make that disclosure. So I don't think the Commission has resolved explicitly.
I don't want to belabor this, but it does affect all of the arguments, I think, on the disclosure part, is that you say that whether this multi-member body expected to be told about patent applications, patents, or plans, whether they expected it is a factual question. Whether, if they did expect to be told, that imposed a duty under the antitrust laws to disclose is a legal question.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Yes, Judge. You point to the stipulation with respect to patents and applications, quote, reading on the devices. But if I understand the Commission's claim, it is that notwithstanding that, there are, I'm not sure of the exact terminology here, continuations, amendments, perhaps divisionals, which refer back to patents and applications pending or in effect during Rambus's participation in JEDEC meetings, and that because they a certain correlation between relating back and a duty to disclose. So even if the original patent, the 898, let's say, doesn't read on the devices, these continuations, et cetera, let me call them progeny, if I may, these progeny, the ones that relate back in time, did, and therefore the obligation, if there was an obligation, applied to them.
Well, that's the Commission's argument, to be sure. And that's rooted in the following patent, basic uncontested patent law propositions. Rambus, in order to have its later filed applications claim time priority over prior art and the like, back to the original application, they had to be based upon the invention that Rambus conceitedly made and described in its initial application filed long before it joined JEDEC. So to that extent, there is a connection. But there is a big difference between talking about relating back to the invention, the description of the invention in the patent, and the claims. Rambus's published claims in its 703 patent and in its international application, which were essentially its first application, were disclosed to all the members in JEDEC. And the Commission said, well, that didn't put them on notice of the possibility of getting other claims, because what we really have to focus on are the particular claims potentially based upon that original invention. So the issue in this case is whether Rambus had an obligation to disclose, an antitrust obligation to disclose its intentions to file in the future new claims that were not yet filed, even though those claims, to be sure, had to be claims based upon the earlier invention.
The language of 21I, and at least I think for our purposes, given deference on factual findings, we probably have to defer to the Commission's conclusion that that represented prior understandings, talks about patents and applications that might be involved. You're saying that every existing, at the time of the meetings, every existing patent or application that might be involved, in other words, that had progeny, which later are claimed to read on to the devices, all of those patents and applications were disclosed. Is that correct?
All applications that, in fact, read on the standard were disclosed. Rambus had no undisclosed claims in either issued patents or pending applications, which is a term used in these documents.
Well, but I guess.
But you're asking
you,
how
you,
about.
You go back to the phrase read on. But
you're saying might
that
some
seems
of them
narrower than might be involved.
Okay. It is true that Rambus had pending patents that one might believe might have been involved in. I'm not sure the Commission actually made such a finding about any such patents, but there were patents about which there was some uncertainty at the time. But JEDEC had no interest, and the Commission didn't find that JEDEC had any interest in inaccurate information, in learning about a patent that didn't read on the standard. The reason I believe that language existed about might read on is to make sure.
It's not even might read on, it's might be involved.
Might be involved in. But what the rule was interested in was patents that, it was concerned with the possibility that those applications, those patents, would in fact read on the standard. If those applications did not read on the standard, the failure to disclose them would in and of itself be of no consequence to JEDEC. The only reason it may matter in this case would be some argument that would say, well, if Rambus had disclosed a patent that might be involved in, but turned out not to be, it might have alerted the JEDEC members that in the future, Rambus could file a different application that would read on the standard.
Are these patents and patent applications secret documents?
Yes. Not the patents. Issued patents are public.
Yeah.
But there is no question, and there's no dispute in this case, that patent applications, and certainly intentions with respect to future applications, are trade secrets. They are uniformly regarded as trade secrets.
Let's go back just to patents, then. Why would there...
The members, the 60 or so members of this committee could go look up the patents themselves. They don't need to have them disclosed to them.
Absolutely. The patents could be subject to public search, and JEDEC didn't even have a policy of doing that, suggesting, obviously, they weren't willing to pay any price to avoid patents. Judge Randolph, I see I'm already into my rebuttal time. There's a lot of ground to cover here.
We're not going to hold you to that.
Thank you very much. Okay. That's absolutely right. With respect to issued patents, they are public, and the key issued patent, the 703, was disclosed by Rambus at JEDEC. But the important point
and the
here,
patents that they got later were basically the very much the same as the original, weren't they?
Well, the claims were clearly different. The claims were different. They did not have any claims in issued or pending patents while they were a member of JEDEC, which necessarily infringed to make these products. So they had new claims based on the original invention. And that is standard patent practice. The Kingstown case in the Federal Circuit and the PINPEP case that we cited make clear that as a matter of patent law and policy, the law wants to permit parties to amend their applications in response to what they learn about the world so that they can be sure to get all the patent protection to which they are entitled by the patent laws. They don't have to play a game of gotcha if they got it right the first time. Now, but the important point, Judge Williams, I understand your concern about, well, they had patents that maybe one could say might be involved in, and if they had disclosed them, perhaps it would have led people to understand that while these patents don't really apply, others in the future might. It all comes back to the question of whether a member at JEDEC had an obligation to disclose the possibility or the likelihood that in the future it would apply for a patent that would read on these standards.
I guess I understand why you say the answer to that should be no, but I'm still concerned that there are undisclosed patents or applications which are the ancestors of the claims that later are asserted by Rambus.
That's clear, but look what the commission did. The commission
is clear in what sense?
No, it's clear that there were ancestors in the earlier application, and that's or at least the original application was an ancestor with respect not to the claims, but to the description of the invention. You know, a patent application has two parts. One describes the invention. I'm going to do this in Rust Belt terms because it's the ones I understand best. Imagine I described an automobile, and I said it had a carburetor, it had a transmission, it had a drive shaft, and whatever else automobiles have. And then I said in my first application, and I claim a patent over the carburetor. Sometime later, I might determine, gee, there's value in having a patent over the transmission, so now I'm going to file a continuation application or amended application, and I'm going to claim a patent over the transmission. If the transmission is described in the initial patent application and that part of the application describes the invention, then I'm entitled to claim that I invented it back then.
Right.
That's
now,
what
think,
was going on
I
here.
Think I get that. But
okay. But
I guess,
in this, let me finish one thought if I may, Judge. So Rambus disclosed, the original application was disclosed through the international process, but more than that, Rambus brought to the attention, in effect, its initial application, the so-called 703, disclosed it to JEDEC. And the commission said, well, that doesn't solve the problem here because the claims in the 703 were different. They didn't read on the particular technologies. They were analogous to the carburetor while JEDEC is standardizing transmissions. And they said, so that doesn't count. What matters is alerting people to the claims. And those claims were all inchoate claims that Rambus might have filed, and as it turned out, did file, beginning in 1997 after it left JEDEC.
Okay, just to make absolutely sure I understand your position, it is that all patents and all applications from which later asserted claims derive were disclosed.
No, just the opposite.
Oh.
The only claims that were asserted have been asserted over the standard for products implementing the standard.
Yeah.
Were claims found in patents applied for in 1997 and thereafter, long after Rambus left JEDEC. So
and
none
the,
of the
and these are not sufficiently related to the prior patents to relate back.
Well, they are in the sense that they were claims on the transmission, and they related back to the description of the invention in the initial patent. But they are not the same claims. They are different claims.
I think I see.
I hope so. This is an important point. And if there's any question,
no, I think I understand it. But I'm sure the commission will have something to say.
Okay. That. Now, the problem, and I want to get to the second. There are two critical flaws in the commission's case, as I see it. One is whether there's an antitrust duty to disclose these kinds of trade secrets, and the other is whether there was any injury to competition. But I want to spend a minute finishing up the first issue and then get to the injury to competition one. The critical problem is this. We're talking here about trade secrets. We're talking about a world in which companies traditionally guard this kind of information, pending applications and even more so intentions with respect to future applications, as vital trade secrets. Rambus's lawyers advised it to keep them as trade secrets. The general counsel of JEDEC advised members to guard their trade secrets. That was commercial custom at the time. And the question then is, under what circumstances do the antitrust laws require a party to disclose that kind of trade secret information to benefit its rivals? And it's important to remember something here. Rambus didn't put any obstacles in the way of any of its rivals. This isn't an exclusive dealing case or a case like Conwood where they destroyed the property. This is a duty to help case. Because if Rambus had never joined JEDEC, there's nothing in the commission's findings or the record to suggest that the world would be any different today from what it is now. So the question is, Rambus joined JEDEC, and under what circumstances, or did that mean that the antitrust laws now impose upon it a duty to share these treasured trade secrets with its competitors? Now, I don't believe...
I guess the commission argument effectively is that when competitors join to work out a standard, there are clear risks of monopolization, and to diminish the impact of that, if the SSO requires certain disclosures, the interest that you're talking about of trade secrets must submit to that.
Well, there are two kinds of answers to that. One is that there's no question that while there are interests in trade, in standard-setting organizations, in patent disclosure, to guard against the harms that Judge Williams just referred to, there are countervailing interests that the standard-setting bodies take very seriously. There are concerns about misinformation, telling someone, gee, I think my patent or my pending patent or my not yet filed application might read on this standard could divert them from a good standard into a bad standard for fear of a patent that turns out not to be well-founded. There are problems of the costs of information processing. As Judge Randolph's question pointed out, JEDEC does not search for patents. They don't want to maximize the cost to avoid the problem of stumbling into a patent. They're weighing costs and benefits. And one of the costs is the cost of evaluating patent disclosure information. This cost, by the way, I'm not making this up. There's testimony about that in this case. There's a McGee memo in 1994. He's the secretary of JEDEC saying we shouldn't require members to file certifications about their patents. There's the FTC DOJ 2007 report on intellectual property and antitrust, which summarizes the costs of disclosure, and there's other materials that we've cited. So there are competing considerations here. And the question is, where did JEDEC strike the balance? And how did it strike that balance? And what we know is there is no contemporaneous evidence, none, that JEDEC expected disclosure of intentions to file future applications. The JEDEC documents refer to pending applications and to patents. And no one while Rambus was a member of JEDEC disclosed an intention to file an application in the future. So I don't think there's any basis to think that JEDEC expected or required disclosure of these inchoate interests. But even if there had been, Even if the commission standing that a finding, well, it wasn't a finding, I don't believe. I think the commission found patents and applications, didn't find expectations. One sentence where they say some witnesses testified. But the declarative statements about what did witnesses expect or what did JEDEC expect talk about patents and applications. But even if the commission had found that there was an expectation of the disclosure of intentions, then the question arises, is that sufficient to create an antitrust duty as opposed to a contract duty or misrepresentation or equitable estoppel? And the answers there are...
That's where I have trouble figuring out what the FTC is saying, because it keeps talking about efficiency gains that were lost by JEDEC. What efficiency gains? I didn't get a clear understanding of the anti-competitive effect, even assuming there was a duty to disclose and there was deception. How did that result in an anti-competitive effect when, and I guess I want to ask you, am I wrong in thinking that Rambus came up with the invention or the claim, whatever it is, that JEDEC would have adopted anyway, the standard, in other words, that superior product language?
Yes, exactly. Judge Hanson, if I can, I'd like to answer your question in part, then go back a little bit to something else, and then come back and talk about that, because it's a very important second chapter of this case. The direct answer to your question is this. What the commission found, although I think it presumed a lot and didn't do it properly, but what they purported to find was that if Rambus had disclosed that in the future it would have a patent on these technologies, that it would have wound up being subject to a so-called RAND commitment, which would have meant lower prices to consumers. I'm going to come back to explain to you why I don't think that's injury to competition within the meaning of the Sherman Act. As to the latter part of your question, yes, Rambus, there's no question, Rambus invented these technologies. They were selected for the standards because they were superior technologies. So in that sense, they were in the standard because of skill, foresight, and industry, because of competition on the merits. Now, if I can go back to a minute to conduct, and then I'll come back to this chapter about injury to competition. The question I was asking is, okay, suppose there had been basis to think that members expected these kinds of disclosures, even though no one had ever made that kind of disclosure. That wouldn't be, in my judgment, or in the case law, an antitrust duty for two basic reasons. One, this is a duty about this is a case about a duty to share property, intellectual property, trade secrets, with rivals in order to make them better off than they would have been if you'd done nothing at all. The case law is clear. Most clearly, the Supreme Court's case decision in Trinco versus Verizon, and also this court's subsequent decision in the Covad case, the case law is clear that parties have a duty to share their property with for the benefit of rivals only if not sharing involves a sacrifice of profits. And the commission was clear here, as it had to be, that no such sacrifice of profits was implicated here. So even if, as in Trinco, remember, recall that in Trinco, the defendant violated a federal statute and breached the contract, and the commission said, doesn't matter, we have to find an antitrust duty, and when it comes to sharing, we have to find a sacrifice of profits. If we don't have that, defendant wins the antitrust case, we don't have a sacrifice of profits here. And secondly, even if one were looking to some extrinsic duty, like JEDEC rules, this particular finding and this rule would fail another antitrust test, and that is, it's not precise enough. It's palpably unclear. The commission could not say what Rambus was supposed to have disclosed, when it was supposed to have disclosed it, or what it was supposed to say about it when it disclosed it. What it said is, we don't like what you did, you should have disclosed it. And there are important antitrust policy reasons embodied in the Antitrust Modernization Commission in a ream of cases that say antitrust duties should be clear so that parties know the line between permissible and impermissible conduct, especially here where we're talking about a duty to cooperate among competitors. After all, the Supreme Court and the lower courts in cases like Allied Tube and Hydrolevel have repeatedly emphasized that the real danger of standard-setting bodies is that they're rife with risk for anti-competitive collusion among competitors. So a rule that requires cooperation among competitors has to be precise and clear so that it can't be subject to abuse, and it has to be precise and clear also because we're dealing with the duty to share property for the benefit of competitors, and there are important antitrust reasons to be reluctant about imposing those kinds of duties.
We might hesitation about that is that we're talking about competitors who are agreeing on what the technology of that all manufacturers will use. In other words, you already have an operation that seems to be fraught with peril for consumers.
Well, it is fraught with peril, which is why we need to be very careful about the
I'm not sure how non-disclosure diminishes the peril to consumers.
Well, imagine the following. You know, and by the way, 21I, you mentioned that 21I, the appendix which specifies what members are supposed to be told, includes a statement that members are supposed to be instructed at every meeting that they are not to disclose to one another their future plans. And yet this is a case about disclosing future plans with respect to patents. But in any event, here's a problem. Suppose we had an amorphous, you really ought to cooperate and disclose your future plans if you think it might help us in the standard setting body. And then I go to you and I say, Judge Williams, I'm kind of working on a patent over here on the transmission. I don't have any interest in the carburetor. You might want to work on a patent in the carburetor area. It could be rife with all sorts of collusion. Certainly with the risk of boycotting technology by others who aren't subject to cross-licenses and who perhaps the manufacturers would rather not deal with. So there is a real danger here, and there's a need, therefore, for clear rules if those rules are going to be enforced by the antitrust laws at all. I'd like to turn to the very important question Judge Henderson asked about the consequences of this conduct. The antitrust laws are clear, it seems to me, that Section 2 is concerned with conduct that excludes rivals and raises entry barriers. A plaintiff in a Section 2 case has to prove that the defendant's monopoly was caused by the conduct, the allegedly wrongful conduct. And yet, it is clear that Rambus's conduct here at JEDEC did not exclude any competitor, and it did not raise any entry barrier. It could have caused Rambus's purported monopoly only if it had caused the standards to be different from what they otherwise would have been. In other words, to have its technology be in the standard as opposed to somebody else's. But the commission explicitly said that it could not find on the facts in this case that Rambus's conduct had that effect.
Well, that takes us to the burden flipping. And the commission relies, of course, on Microsoft, which
right.
did flip the burden. Now, you distinguish in terms of acquisition of a monopoly versus maintenance of a monopoly. So that appeared to be the distinction you relied on. But I guess you didn't explain to me why that should be a compelling distinction.
I'm glad you asked that, because this is an important distinction. The Microsoft case is different from this case in two very critical respects. The fact that it was a maintenance case as opposed to an acquisition case is not a doctrinal difference. It was a way of trying to frame the factual question before the court. In the Microsoft case, Microsoft had an existing monopoly. This case, Rambus didn't, and it gained one. Okay. In the Microsoft case, the court found the following. It found over and over again, page after page, as I'm sure your honors know at least as well as I, that Microsoft's anti-competitive conduct harmed Netscape and Java, both of which were important potential facilitators of new entry. And the court found that as a result of that, it made entry more difficult, reduced the likelihood of entry. In effect, it found that Rambus's conduct increased entry barriers.
No, you mean Microsoft.
I'm sorry, Microsoft's county. Thank you, Judge Randall. That was enough to satisfy the injury to competition requirement in a maintenance case, because in a maintenance case, if you raise entry barriers, you've insulated your monopoly from competition. There's no such finding here.
You're saying essentially there was no burden flipping in Microsoft?
Well, no, there's a second part. There's a second difference. So there was no finding here of any such effect. In addition, Microsoft went on to say, and we realize that we can't specify exactly what would happen but for this conduct. Because we can't tell you what would happen in the, quote, I use this word, quote, hypothetical competition that would take place in the future with emerging technologies whose identity we don't even know. And it said, under those circumstances, having already found increased entry barriers, under those circumstances, evidence or proof that Microsoft's conduct quashed nascent competitors is enough. In this case, we're not dealing with hypothetical competition that might have taken place in the future. We're dealing with actual competition between Rambus's technology and alternatives that have been suggested as possible alternatives. There's no mystery about who they were. Both parties put in evidence at trial about those alternatives. And the commission looked at the competition that took place in the past between known alternatives and Rambus's technology and said, on this record, we can't conclude anything other than that Rambus's technology was superior and chosen on the merits, and we can't conclude that the outcome would have been any different. It's a very different case, I think, Judge Williams, between looking back and looking at hypothetical competition in the future, and it's very different because there was harm to competition found in Rambus in terms of in Microsoft, I'm sorry, in terms of the increased entry barriers. If the commission's view of Section 2 were correct, then anybody who engaged in anti-competitive conduct that might injure competition would be able to say, I've won the Section 2 case. You would be without any proof of injury to competition. And the cases are unanimous in rejecting that proposition. Cases we cited like Aquatherm and Berkey, which involved deceptive conduct, where the court said, sure, it was deceptive conduct. But if it didn't affect market shares, exclude rivals, raise entry barriers, it's not a Section 2 violation. In COVID, although we didn't cite it, this court's post-Trinco case, in a different part of it from the one I talked about a moment ago, the court looked at deceptive conduct, false advertising by the defendant, and said, look, that may impose costs on consumers because they have to sort out the misinformation. But that's not enough unless you can connect it to an exclusion of rivals and an increase in entry barriers. All the cases say that. And that's the fundamental problem with this case. Is that the commission could not reject, it explicitly said, we can't reject the proposition that Rambus got its monopoly by having the best invention on the merits, skill, foresight, and industry. And if that's true, this case is over. There can't be a Section 2 violation under those circumstances.
Can I go back to just one
sure.
thing that I think you said, yeah, and I think it's in the briefs, that the patents, well, certainly let's stick to the patents. The patents were disclosed. When you say disclosed, let's say the extant patents at the
right,
time
the issued
of,
patents,
of
yes.
the meetings, they were disclosed. Do you mean that they were disclosed in the sense of being available at the patent office, or they were put on the table by Rambus? The
703, which is essentially the basic first patent, was put on the table. It was brought to the attention at JEDEC by Rambus. Now, I frankly don't recall what they said about it or anything else, but it was brought to their attention, and my recollection is the commission said that wasn't sufficient notice of all that happened later because the claims of the 703 were different. It was the carburetor, not the transmission.
Okay.
During the time that Rambus was a member of the JEDEC, It did have pending applications, patent applications, outstanding.
Yes.
After it left, to the extent that any of those pending applications ripened into actual patents, are any of those patents necessary for this SDRAM or the DDR SDRAM?
None of those patents has been asserted by Rambus. And I don't know the answer to your question. I'm not sure what the record says about it. I don't think the record suggests that any of them is necessary, but I do know that none of them has been asserted.
Okay.
And maybe I should save whatever time I have for rebuttal then. Thank you.
May it please the court, John Davey for respondent of the Federal Trade Commission. Your Honor, in this monopolization case, there is no question that Rambus achieved monopoly power in four critical technology markets. So the question is, under the basic two-part test for monopolization, did they achieve that through competition on the merits or by exclusionary acts? The commission, having taken a long, hard look at this course of conduct over 5 years determined that it was exclusionary and not competition on the merits.
Let's just go back a minute. If I understand the Commission's conclusion, it is that as a result of Rambis's impermissible conduct, put it that way, a standard was adopted which would not otherwise have been adopted, or a RAND commitment was not extracted which would have been extracted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So these are findings in the alternative.
That's correct.
Okay. That seems to me very critical, since slightly different from the way you put it, I think.
Well, I think if you want, we can jump ahead to the causation issue, which is
well,
what
no,
this
no,
largely
no,
goes
I did,
to.
I did, it was just that your formulation seemed too broad, so I wanted
well,
to.
Well, I mean, our point really, well, let me start by pointing out that this case is really not properly viewed as involving a distinct duty to disclose arising under either state or federal law. What the Commission recognized here is that the deception, when practiced in a context in which it is capable of creating enduring market power, is among the myriad means that the courts have recognized through which monopoly may be achieved. And this goes to something that's very basic to our economic system, the importance of good information. Economic models on which efficiency is based consistently assume that people have good information about what they're making decisions about.
But not trade secrets.
Well, it depends on the context, Your Honor. Here, of course, if Rambis had simply stayed out, they would have had no obligation to do anything. But what they did is they...
What should they have disclosed?
Good point, Your Honor. I think a lot of the talk about particular applications and particular claims misses the point. One of the JEDEC members, Mr. Sussman from Sanyo, had a good phrase.
But anybody that's a member of this group knows that Rambis is a company that's not just sitting on its hands, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It is trying to develop patents in this area. It doesn't manufacture anything. All it does, it makes all its money by licensing the patents. And they weren't just sitting around. Everybody knows that.
Well, everyone knows that, Your Honor. But what people also knew was that Rambis voluntarily became a member of this organization, an organization that had written practices and consistently followed policies by its members. And to answer your question, Mr. Sussman from Sanyo, page 1980 of the Joint Appendix, said important is not the claims themselves, because claims can change. What we needed was the concept. And you know, what Rambis should have done to have allayed the misimpression that it was creating was actually quite simpler than what Rambis would have you think. Take, for example, the technology of programmable latency. This may be something fairly complicated for you or me. It certainly was for me. But to these folks, this was a simple matter. Programmable latency, yes or no vote. Even on the final specification, it was only a page. All Rambis had to say is, hey, folks, we think that programmable latency is one of the many things that our esteemed founders invented back in 1989. We have a pending application. We're not quite sure if it covers it or not yet. We're working on it. If they had simply made that revelation, there's no question from this record that things would have happened
differently. To take your example, I asked the counsel for Rambis, are you maintaining that applications that Rambis had pending during its membership have now ripened into patents that are necessary to operate, for example, SD-RAM?
We would say the continuations and amendments of them are, yes. I mean, I think Rambis is trying to take a very...
Did the Commission make that finding? I don't recall the Commission making that.
There's no question that patents that come from the same family...
Well, I know that, but that wasn't my question. My question was, did Rambis have a patent application pending during its membership that ripened into a patent that's now necessary in order to operate SD-RAM? That's a very...
There's no finding to that effect, Your
Honor. There's no finding, no. So your hypothetical, the statement that you gave showing, on the latency thing is purely hypothetical. It's not factual.
It's not hypothetical, Your Honor, because here was the situation. Mr. Crisp is sitting in a room where people are talking about programmable latency. He knows that his folks back at Rambis are working on making sure that technology is covered. Indeed, when you look at the original documents, In May of 92, when all this is beginning, Mr. Tate, the CEO of Rambus, is saying, we think we have intellectual property in SDRAM, and if we don't, we'll fix things so that we do. Everything goes back to those original inventions.
But if the original inventions, in the form at least of the patent, have mm-hmm. been disclosed in the form of put on the table at JEDEC, what you're saying is that Rambus has not only put on the table the ancestors of the ultimate claims, but must disclose day by day the progress that Rambus is making on turning the descriptions in the patent into claims. Is that correct?
It's not a matter of day by day progress, Your Honor.
Well, they were. They'll take month by month.
Well, but they were part of a process, and you know the record shows that at the very first meeting they went to, Mr. Garrett came back and noted with some surprise that well, there was a standard mentioned, and Fujitsu said, well, they have a pending patent on it. And then when you go on through their history, every meeting they go to, the duty to disclose is mentioned, the sense of cooperation is mentioned. They knew that by their very presence
But you're somewhat avoiding the question of mm-hmm. precisely what it is they had to disclose that they didn't disclose.
What they had to
and
do
certainly
is
it's a it is at least a problem if they if what is required is disclosing in the sense of saying what progress we're making on something which already has been disclosed.
But what they had to do is not mislead. And that was the problem. By their presence there month after month at these meetings, and their and while these meetings were talking about distinct technologies, programmable burst length, programmable latency, and Mr. Crisp knew, I mean, indeed, the documents indicated various times Rambus thought they already had patents on this, but in the applications that were pending. And they said, well, we think we may have it covered already, but we'll keep working to make sure that we get it covered. What this was largely a matter of is, you know, the initial application appeared to most observers, even including these very technical people, appeared to involve only this unique architecture called RDRAM that they had invented. Now, Rambus was successful, ultimately convincing PTO.
Is there any example of any other member during the course of this body's existence coming and saying, hey, I want you guys to know that we're working on something and something?
Well, IBM had done it just immediately prior to Rambus's joining JEDEC and on a different JEDEC committee. I mean, keep in mind, Your Honor,
this is the FTC's position is that Rambus had to give up property, had to share its property with the 60 other members, right? That is your position.
No, it really isn't, Your Honor.
Do you agree that what they should have disclosed was trade secrets?
Only because they had put themselves in the situation
we're dealing with trade secrets. I mean, you can't deny that, right?
That's true, Your
okay.
Honor.
The Supreme Court has held that trade secrets are property. And so what you're saying, and I don't think there's any question about that, the tax laws treat trade secrets as property. So you're saying Rambus had to give up its property.
Your Honor, we're saying that Rambus made a voluntary decision to join JEDEC, to become part of a cooperative industry process that proceeded on the basis of mutual understanding of cooperation. They presented themselves as a member of this organization. They made selective disclosures, which actually tended even more to mislead. Mr. Melman talked about the disclosure of the 703 patent. Well, the 703 patent did not relate to these technologies.
That's
the 1990s.
It had further restrictions that meant that it would not cover any of these technologies. But my point being that
You're saying then that the 703 is not in any way the ancestor, to use my term, of the claims ultimately asserted?
It is not actually. If you look at the patent tree, which was
it's the 1990 patent that's the ancestor.
Yes, the 898 application is the ancestor of everything. The 703 patent was somewhere in the middle, and it's not even, if you follow the tree from the original application to the six patents that Rambus ultimately used in litigation, the 703 is off to one side. There were other routes that were taken. I mean, this stuff is quite complicated. As you know, there were 150 claims in the first patent, and then there were many more. The point is that the people who originally looked at it, including these technical folks, thought it only related to this particular RDRAM architecture. Ultimately, Rambus was able to convince the PTO that a lot of these other subsidiary inventions were inherently in there, but this was not in the original.
In the 898.
Yes, in there in the sense that...
In the 898 was not put before JEDEC, or was put before JEDEC?
In a virtual sense, it was, because the European version of it was known. But when they didn't...
Known in what sense?
It was made public. In fact, it was discussed.
Okay. So in other words, the intellectual ancestor of the ultimate claims made was openly discussed at JEDEC meetings.
Right, and they didn't understand, even the technical folks that they were, that those claims were broad enough to cover these basic technologies.
But you say Rambus persuaded the PTO that it was.
What they did is they amended their claims. They made new claims. They all went back to the basic written description.
But you are resting on the proposition that a participant in the meetings has an obligation to disclose at some intervals work in progress.
In a sense, yes, Your Honor, because that's what...
Independent of applications... Let's say independent, in other words, not work in progress which has not been embodied in a filed application.
There were filed applications that Rambus itself believed would be adequate. It turns out later that they were able to further refine those applications so that the ones they actually used in litigation years later were different than the ones that were pending at the time. But they all came from the same place. And in fact,
the place from which they came... Mm-hmm. was disclosed in the most formal sense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
On the table.
That's correct.
How much work has to be, work in progress, how much work has to be done? How do you define when?
I think if you look at the facts of this case, Your Honor, I mean, I do not believe that we are unfairly trying to get people to give up property. These folks went into this organization voluntarily and with a plan. The plan from the outset was to try to make sure that they got coverage of the industry-wide standard. How did they do that? They did that in part by going into this organization, presenting themselves as a cooperative member of the organization, listening to everything that was said, and using that information to further refine these complicated patent claims.
But listening to, I thought these were public meetings. They didn't have to join the organization.
They're not public meetings. The minutes, which are very sketchy, apparently are made public, but the meetings are not. They had to join to attend these meetings, and they did. And they not only used that information, but they sat there knowing these very basic technologies were being discussed as to be made industry standards, and there were alternatives to each and every one of them.
So it's just the minutes that are public?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. And there were alternatives, Judge Henderson, you mentioned this earlier, to each and every one of these technologies. Rambus has claimed that these are the best, but the commission never found that. What the commission focused on was the fact that these technologies are supposed to be competing. And that's the efficiency loss that we were talking about. The beauty of standard-setting organizations when they work well is that the industry folks can come together and make a standard that will benefit consumers. And then there's a couple of ways that works. I mean, in something like this, not only the pieces have to fit together, and that's part of the standards, but also in this case, where the industry folks were agreeing on basic specifications, that allowed these chips to become essentially commodity products where manufacturers could compete on the basis of production efficiencies. All that's good for consumers if the decisions are being made rationally. But to make a rational decision, you need to know not only what the competing technology's advantages are, but you also need to know the costs. And Rambus was withholding that information because it had in its back pocket these patent claims that it was eventually going to increase the cost of these technologies by billions.
But these are claims that are can be traced to disclosed patent or patents.
It's true, Your Honor, but you know, when any court looks at deception, and that can be in an antitrust case, in a consumer protection case, a securities case, you look at the communications that are made in context. And in here, the context, you start with these very complicated applications, and yes, some information was released, some information was withheld. The net effect and the intended effect was to mislead the members of JEDEC into thinking that they could adopt these standards without facing patent costs. I want to get back to that 703.
How would things be different if Rambus never joined this organization?
We don't know that, Your Honor.
The people would, you know, your argument that for efficiency, and you have to do this with your eyes open. You have to know what's out there, what the potential costs are. All those arguments could be made whether Rambus joined the organization or didn't join the organization.
But if Rambus hadn't joined the organization, it would not have affirmatively misled these folks, which it did. And it did that
It did that by material omissions, right?
By material omissions, and I'd like to get back to the 703 patent I mentioned. They disclosed that, and they made a big deal of the fact that they disclosed that. Later on in 1995, when Rambus was questioned about another technology, Mr. Crisp said, "Well, yes, we may have some patents related to SyncLink, but keep in mind we have previously disclosed our patents when we disclosed the 703." I would say that for him to make that statement is affirmatively misleading. Also, when Rambus,
I'm sorry, is the argument that his language with respect to the 703 took JEDEC members' eye off
it lulled,
98 or its European equivalent?
It lulled them into thinking that JEDEC, that Rambus was cooperating in the usual manner.
Bring that down a little more, it seems to me.
Excuse me? What?
If disclosure of the underlying patent or patent applications meets 21I, then if that was done, then your use of what was said as to 703, it seems to me to work only if it sort of tells the JEDEC members, well, forget about this other stuff has been disclosed.
I think by disclosing selectively, they were misleading the folks.
Disclosing selectively, but I thought I'd understood you to say that the 898 or its European equivalent was disclosed and was discussed.
It was, but these people did not understand the potential breadth of that original description. I mean, Rambus was making refinements to the claims, making new claims based on it. I mean, ultimately they said, well, we invented all this stuff back in 1989, but simply because we didn't refine our claims until 1997, we had nothing to disclose in 1993. I mean, that seems
then Mr. Melodiff's correct in saying that you're demanding that there be disclosure of work in progress independent of or that is not manifested in an application, right?
Well, they had existing applications that they themselves thought would cover this stuff, but they were continuing.
Those turn out not to
yes.
be pertinent.
But I mean, I think it's a mistake, Your Honor, to take too formalistic a view of this and look at only particular claims and applications. I mean, the information to be conveyed here was quite simple, that we're working on getting this patent on programmable burst length. We think we already have it. We're trying to make it better. I mean, that's what was going on here.
Can I go to something else? And that is, that you have, and I caught you on this at the outset, there are alternative findings as to the effect.
That's right, Your Honor.
Of the behavior. And And the commission effectively admits it's unable to decide which alternative outcome would have followed, non-adoption of the standard or extraction of a RAND commitment.
Right.
You would agree, I take it, that in terms of Rambus's liability, it must be the least damaging to Rambus finding on which the commission would rely.
In terms of remedy, I would say that that is true. In terms of liability, I don't think we even need to get that far.
Well,
let me explain, Your Honor.
Okay,
I mean, as this court held in Microsoft, if a company is engaging in anti-competitive behavior, as long as that behavior is capable of contributing significantly to the creation of monopoly power, that can be enough for liability. The courts have always understood that when a monopoly is created, it's always because of a confluence of considerations.
I think you're on a somewhat different issue from what I was trying to get at. The only finding is this one, the critical finding is the one made in the alternative, right? If you want to frame it as liability, I think they equate in the end. You have got to say, to find a Section 2 violation, that behavior producing the absence of a RAND commitment is a Section 2 violation.
I do not believe we have to do that for the liability part.
Why not? In other words,
suppose
an agency makes a finding in the alternative that that certain behavior produced effect A or effect B, we can't tell, and then it goes to build on effect A without recognizing that all it said is that A or B must have followed.
I don't think you need to get that far. Remember, the basic test for monopolization is the existence of monopoly power plus anti-competitive behavior that contributed to that. I mean,
no.
There's no question.
But the point is that the stated anti-competitive behavior may, on the commission's findings, have contributed only to the absence of a RAND commitment. Right?
No, there's no question that Rambus's behavior contributed to the selection of its technologies and therefore its attainment of monopoly power. I mean, in Microsoft,
there are a number of places where the commission is quite explicit at framing its finding as to effects in the alternative.
As to effects, Your Honor, yes, but. I think that jumps ahead, though, of the basic monopolization test, which is that there's no question that Rambus has attained monopoly power, and that part of what led to that was its behavior at JEDEC. That should be enough.
I don't follow.
If we don't know which effect followed from the behavior, the absence of the RAND commitment or the selection of the standard.
Right.
You're now leaping to the assumption that it's the selection of the standard, but that's not what the commission found.
I really don't think that's so, Your Honor, but I'm happy to
back up. I just want to add to that, because I'm having the same problem that Judge Williams is, that if you cannot say that but for the conduct of Rambus, this standard would not have been adopted, if you can't say that, then I don't see where the contributed to business helps you at all.
The creation of a standard itself is an event that takes place because of the confluence of many causal factors. I mean, the information that the folks had, the various inventions that were made, and Rambus's deception. All those were causative factors that led to the adoption of these standards.
Yeah, but you frame the find at you, the commission. Framed the finding in the alternative.
Okay. Well, that's
right.
There's no question, Your Honor, that yes, the commission framed the finding in the alternative, and yes, we would say that if you need to go there, then yes, that alternative finding shows you that but for this conduct, there would not have been monopoly power.
No. Because under one fork of it, all it shows is that Rambus would not be in a position to seek the royalties that but,
but, but what is monopoly power, Your Honor? Monopoly power is the ability to obtain super competitive prices.
But we've excluded the key step in the monopoly power, and that is the actual selection of this particular standard.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the raison d'etre for the RAND commitment rule at JEDEC was to prevent anyone from getting real monopoly power.
No, it's to lower the costs, which is a different proposition altogether.
Well, I don't think that's so, Your Honor, because the very thing they wanted to prevent was for someone.
There is a JEDEC participant who will get a monopoly as a result of the selection of its standard, and it makes a RAND commitment, its monopolist, who is obliged to charge less high royalties, lower royalties than would otherwise have been able to.
But that's
charge,
the very essence of monopoly power.
No, it isn't. No. I think what you're describing is simply someone who acquires a monopoly and who, by deception, et cetera, is able to charge more for the exercise of the monopoly power than it would have been otherwise.
I think
which sounds kind of like 9X. Not exactly 9X.
No, it's not, Your Honor, because see, in Discon 9X, 9X had obtained its monopoly through a wholly different process.
Right.
It had obtained it legitimately, and it had obtained it through a public law process. Here, Rambus has used the private standard setting organization to leverage the joint power of that organization to give it monopoly power. And
But you, the Commission, refrained from a finding that the consequence was the selection of the standard as opposed to these alternative findings. No?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is I think if you go back to, I believe it's in Microsoft, I know it's said many places, monopoly power is the ability to charge super competitive prices. What JEDEC was doing by having the RAND commitment was preventing that from ever happening. So in economic terms,
you seem to keep having it both ways. You go back to causation of monopoly versus deceptive exploitation of the monopoly.
I don't think we're talking about
radically different propositions.
We're not talking about deceptive exploitation. We're talking about monopoly power having been created through deception. There's no question that at the end of the day, Rambus has monopoly power. It obtained it in large part through deception. And I think the alternative finding simply shows you that there are two possible outcomes, either of which would have been better for consumers, and neither of which would have entailed genuine monopoly power.
But it's better for consumers if a monopolist does not trick its licensees into paying too much, right?
Well, that's certainly true, Your Honor. But more fundamentally,
you have to go to market structure, not to impact on consumers.
Well, I think the basic economic definition of monopoly power is really not based entirely on market structure, but upon the ability to obtain super competitive prices. I mean, the Third Circuit recognized this in Broadcom, that the absence of RAND commitment really is what gives you the monopoly power that you wouldn't otherwise have.
We're not bound by the Third Circuit.
Of course you're not, Your Honor, but we think their decision is quite good.
I'd still like to know when. I really don't understand, as a rule of law, that would govern for the future for all these standard-setting bodies that have all these members. When is it that your work on a particular area has matured enough so that you have to disclose it to all your competitors?
It depends upon both the rules, the mores of the organization, and the facts. Here, we think the facts were quite straightforward. They already had patents. Applications pending that they internally thought might well read on these technologies. At the very least, they knew they were trying to refine their patent claims so that they would read on these technologies. That, in our view, is enough. And then the real question is your conduct deceptive? Are you deceiving people by continuing to come to these meetings, by making selective disclosures? And let me point out another affirmative misstatement they made is when they left JEDEC, they gave a supposed list of their patents. They left out the 327 patent. Now, the 327 patent is actually quite important because even though they didn't ultimately use it in their litigation, at the time they referred to that as a part of the minefield of intellectual property that would cover SDRAM. So that was another affirmative misstatement on their part to say, here are our patents, and they left out the only one that could possibly have mattered at that point.
Now, that's after the adoption of SDRAM.
That's right.
Right?
But if you look at Appendix F to the 21I manual, it indicates that even if you find out after the fact that you have intellectual property interests in a standard, you should reveal that also.
Let me turn to DDR SDRAM.
Yes, sir.
We have the survey ballot.
Right.
Well, and Rambus is in JEDEC at that point. And then it's not altogether clear to me. There seems to be at least this meeting in December 96, I think, maybe 95, anyway, that Rambus attends.
Right. It was December of 95.
95, okay.
Yes.
Do we know to what extent there were substantive discussions at that meeting?
We know there was discussion because another member, Mossad, piped up and said, now that we have the survey ballot back and we see that people seem to be on board with putting on chip PLL, I should tell you that we, Mossad, I have a pending patent that we think may relate to this technology. You know, Mr. Crisp, by contrast, sat there and said nothing, even though he knew perfectly well that Rambus had patents that they both had patents pending that they thought might cover this technology, and he knew they were also still working on refining and broadening their patents to make sure it was covered.
Let's put aside working. Are the patents other than, the claims ultimately asserted by Rambus with respect to...
were all filed after they were out.
Yes, but they are or not rooted in the 898 or its European equivalent.
Everything at issue in this case is rooted in that initial 1990 application. And that's why we say, I think it really borders on sophistry for them to say that, they invented, that they got patent protection by saying that they invented all this stuff in 1990, and then for them to say, we had nothing to disclose in 1993 and 1994.
The Federal Circuit rejected the argument that you just were making in response to Judge Williams' question about the survey, didn't they?
Well, they were operating under a different claim. They were operating under a state law fraud claim that I think has a different legal standard, which is probably stronger than this one. Moreover, I would refer the court to Judge Prost's dissent, which has much to commend it. And finally, of course, that ruling isn't binding on this court.
Well, I know that.
Can I ask you, I was struck with your, with the concurring opinion of Mr. Leibowitz.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that there would have been an easier way for the FTC to do what it wanted to do. I see it as the FTC has this fairly toothless organization. It may be toothless, the SSO. It may be toothless because mm-hmm. of antitrust laws. It may be toothless because they can't get people to join otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had stopped at just the deception, if you'd gone under Section 5 of the FTC Act and left the monopolization alone, it seems to me there's been tremendous overreaching here by the FTC, that you've used a sledgehammer, and you may end up, these SSOs may go out of existence. When you start injecting antitrust violations into this, when something much less than a sledgehammer would have taken care of it.
Well, I'm not sure that's really true, Your Honor. I mean, obviously the choice not to go with the pure Section 5 theory is the one that is a matter of prosecutorial discretion that we can't change now. I don't think this is a sledgehammer at all, Your Honor, because even though what started this was deception, the result was the creation of monopoly. And in our view, the monopoly that wouldn't otherwise have existed. And that's why I think it was appropriate for the commission to go forward in Section 2. And the notion that monopoly comes from deception is not unique to this case.
But I'm not sure I agree with you that the monopoly wouldn't have existed otherwise, because your commission found that it was a superior product.
No, we did not find that it was a superior product. The commission went on at great length to discuss the relative pluses and minuses of the various alternatives, and there were alternatives for each of these, along with the costs. All the commission concluded at the end of that is that they couldn't conclusively determine that these technologies would have been chosen anyway. They thought it was in doubt because of because of the costs, and which Rambus never allowed the organization itself to understand the proper trade-off between the costs and the benefits of the technology.
Are these technologies still being used?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Judge Anderson. I'll try to be very brief. I want to make, if I can, two brief points about the duty, the conduct element, and then a couple points about the causation element. One of the points that I emphasized in my opening comments and that we talked about in the brief was the importance that antitrust duties be clear. One thing is clear after this argument, and that is that the Commission is unable to articulate a clearer standard here. Even today, they cannot tell you what it is we were supposed to have disclosed, or when we were supposed to have disclosed it, or what we were supposed to have said about it. And Mr. Daly said, well, we're supposed to talk not about claims, but about concepts. I don't think that solves the clarity problem. And he talked, of course, about the spirit of cooperation, and that doesn't give you much guidance about the particular terms under which you should do what people customarily do not do, namely disclose your trade secrets for the benefit of rivals. The second point, as in their brief, Mr. Daly emphasized the refrain of, well, it wasn't just a case of not sharing our trade secrets with our competitors, we misled them. And he talked about lulling, and he talked about using information at JEDEC. The problems are twofold. First of all, if you look carefully at the allegedly misleading conduct, it doesn't look so misleading. One of the things they talked about, for example, was our response to an inquiry about Synclink. Synclink, we got an inquiry, it's a different technology. Do you care to speak about your patents? We responded and said, no, we're not going to speak about our patents, and then said that our, quote, silence should not be taken, this is a paraphrase, should not be taken as a statement one way or the other as to whether we have patents. There's nothing misleading about that. But more important, the commission made no finding that any of this conduct, I think to use your question, Judge Williams, threw them off the track, that but for this conduct, they would have known about our technology, and we somehow led them astray. There is no finding about that at all, nor is there any finding that but for our membership at JEDEC, we would not have gotten the patents that we are asserting today, which, after all, were filed after we left and are based on the invention that we
But that's not the claim. The claim is not that you wouldn't have gotten the patents. The claim has to relate to that the standard would have been different, or it would have imposed these reasonable conditions.
I understand that. I think to some extent they suggested that, well, we misused information at JEDEC, and I'm saying that's a red herring.
Are those meetings public?
The meetings are not public. The minutes, which are not so cursory, the minutes are public. The SDRAM standard was published in 1993. That was all public by then. The data sheets for DDR were published in 1997, or during the time that the pertinent applications were being filed. Now, as to effects, Judge Williams, I completely agree that that finding, I'm not sure it's a finding, we addressed that in our reply brief, but that finding, if it is a finding, cannot support the conclusion because it said, well, we find either that they injured competition or that they didn't injure competition. The suggestion by Mr. Daly
And that argument, in your view, holds regardless of the burden of proof issue.
That's correct. That's correct. The finding is defective. One, I don't think it was a finding. Two, it was based on purpose, which is not sufficient. Three, it was infected by the failure of the misallocation of the burden of proof because they didn't consider a lot of the evidence. But even if it were a valid finding, regardless of all of those problems, it's simply a finding that either they injured competition or they didn't, which can't support a Section 2 case. My final point I want to make is about the Discon case. I think, Judge Williams, you're quite right. The Discon case stands for the proposition that fraudulent conduct in that case by a monopolist to avoid a pricing constraint that the court explicitly said injured consumers is not enough for a Section 2 problem, that Section 2 has to do with excluding rivals and raising entry barriers. Now, Mr. Daly said, well, it's different here because the monopoly there was totally unrelated to the course of conduct at issue. And I think there are three responses to that. One, it misses the point of what Discon and the other cases we cited are all about, which is this point that you made, Judge Williams, and that is Section 2 is concerned about structural problems, about excluding rivals, and about raising entry barriers. It's not concerned about this, about consumer injury. Two, it's inconsistent with the Newman v. Universal case, which we cited, which was a case in which basically parties entered into a contract, then conspired to renege on the contract, and the court said that's not a violation of Section 2 because it doesn't affect the structure of the market, even though the dependence of the promisee on the contract was, of course, part and parcel of the course of conduct. And finally, there is no case that I'm aware of and no case that the Commission has cited that suggests that they can have a Section 2 violation without showing the kind of structural harm that the Commission explicitly said was not proven here. And if Your Honors have no more questions, prepare to end.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.